This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is television critic David Mark. David Mark was already an avid TV watcher when he learned to read. He says that the banality of Dick and Jane readers was not lost on him. By then, he'd already seen World War II, narrated by Walter Cronkite on the series 20th Century. Television is inarguably part of our shared culture, and Mark thinks it's important that we analyze it with more depth than do most television critics who run through their reviews of winners and losers, smugly asking why the same junk every year. Mark writes about television for The Village Voice and The Atlantic Magazine and teaches at Brandeis. The title of his book about television, Demographic Vistas, is a pun on the Walt Whitman essay Democratic Vistas. Whitman called for a homegrown American literature whose subject would be the average, the democratic, and the popular. Mark thinks television is an ironic fulfillment of Whitman's dream, where the average and the popular are computed through demographic analysis, then interpreted by network executives. I was surprised to learn from David Mark that The Beverly Hillbillies was one of the most popular series ever on TV. Mark says that The Beverly Hillbillies was a departure from all the sitcoms that preceded it and led the genre in a new direction.
Well, it wasn't as obsessed with moral allegory as, let's say, Leave It to Beaver or Father Knows Best. There wasn't this incredible kind of instruction in each episode to learn an utterly banal ethical lesson about life. Instead, it was simply dedicated to laughs. And yet at the same time, it called up a theme which has been pervasive in American culture since America started, which is the conflict between wealth and nature. One thing I go into in the Beverly Hillbillies chapter is a play called The Contrast by Royal Tyler, which was the first play that was ever written and produced in America, 1789, written by an American and produced in America. And the subject of the play were pioneer folk from western Massachusetts who come to the big city, and everyone's trying to rip them off, and they're morally spotless, and in other words, the Beverly Hillbillies.
The person who wrote it is someone who you make sound like a real auteur of television sitcoms. Who is he, and what else did he do?
Oh, Paul Henning. Yes, that's a very important point to me, that television shows simply don't come out of thin air, but they're really the work of individual people. Paul Henning, for example, who did The Beverly Hillbillies. I think anyone would recognize his other programs just from his style and his subject matter. They include Petticoat Junction and Green Acres, of course, his trilogy masterwork. His earlier work included, he was a writer for Burns and Allen on the original Burns and Allen show. And his first show that was his show was Love That Bob, the old Bob Cummings show. And even in that show, you can see the themes of the Beverly Hillbillies beginning to gather. For example, Bob Cummings plays the part of this Hollywood swinging bachelor who goes out with all these models and starlets. Meanwhile, his sister has come from the Midwest and is trying to bring up her son, played by Dwayne Hickman, who later becomes Dobie Gillis, in the righteous moral manner of a good Midwestern family. And so we have the conflict between California, which represents the brave new world of amorality, versus the, quote, all-American traditions of the Midwest. As Henning gained success with that show, he was then able to take his vision, into this really kind of precipitate with the Beverly Hillbillies.
Do you think we can see television as the product of a series of auteurs whose vision is played out in several different series?
I think we ought to when it's there. I mean, you can take a walk on the street, and ask, do a man on the street interview. Ask people who wrote Ulysses. And a lot of them can tell you that James Joyce wrote it, though they never read it. On the other hand, they may have spent 100 hours watching the Beverly Hillbillies, but ask them anything about who was connected with it, and they won't know. And I think there's a real danger in that. It's not just an academic point. that somehow today we're told that television is not an art. It's based on, quote, mass communications theory. It's a bunch of people in white coats with rats running around in mazes trying to figure out how to make us, consume 2.3% more hamburgers or something like that. And, of course, that goes on. But beneath that, there's finally, the dirty hands of individuals at work. I mean, look at Paul Henning's life. Where was he born? Not in New York or California, but in Missouri. I have these quotations from him. He based many characters, including Granny, on people that he knew as a child. And like any artist, he exaggerated, he changed things, and so forth. But finally, we have the same elements that go into any traditional notion of art present on television. There's a writer who's writing dialogue. There's a camera person who is imagining camera angles. And that even if there's never been a single good television program on in the history of television, there's no structural reason why there can't be. And so if we want to talk about it, let's get away from all of this kind of sociological jargon being thrown around, and let's talk about shows. What shows do you like and what shows don't you like? Anyone who watches television knows that some shows are better than others. And once you've established that, you're in the realm of aesthetics.
One of the really interesting things about television, like if we were talking about a novel that we'd both read and we wanted to use that as an example, we'd have to explain it so that everyone would understand. I'd never assume that everyone had read the same novel. But if we're talking about Beverly Hillbillies, I feel under no compulsion to explain what the Beverly Hillbillies is.
It's true. It's really our cultural currency. I mean, as a college professor who deals with this, I have walked into classrooms in New York, Iowa, Providence, Rhode Island, and addressed a group of freshmen, in the case of Iowa, 18-year-old kids right off the farm, and brought up, obscure episodes of The Twilight Zone from 1962, which, many of them were made before some of them were born, perhaps, and they've seen them in the reruns. And in a way, it's like the English teacher's dream, to be able to walk into the classroom, refer to some obscure 18th century text, and every student in the class has not only read it, but has a strong opinion about what it means.
Now, although you're saying we should look at TV according to what shows we like and talk about which ones we like and which ones we don't, you do talk about how ratings and demographics affect the way people are characterized and the settings of the shows. And you even suggest that the vision of the family and who has the most authority in the family is based on consumer patterns and who demographically has the most purchase power within the family.
Well, it's certainly true that if one looks at who is controlling the purse strings in the family in the 1950s, father certainly did know best. And as we see a shift away from that, as we see women working more and the social revolution which follows that of women having more control over the purse strings, we also get a change in heroics happening as well. Another issue is age. I think All in the Family, as the antagonist of Father Knows Best, shows us that. Whereas in Father Knows Best, Jim, the father, is consistently the source of morality, whereas the wife and the children are tend toward errant deeds. We have precisely the opposite thing, where Archie is the recipient of lessons from whom? The woman and the children. And which two groups are on the rise? The baby boomers, represented by Mike and Gloria, and the wife.
Television has frequently been very slow to actually pick up on the social issues and political issues of the day. Do you think that that response time has changed at all? Like All in the Family is always applauded for being a show that was very brave in really talking about the social themes and in having showing someone who is racist and other people who were opposed to racism. There was a hint of the conflict going on there between generations. But do you think it was really socially relevant for its time?
People, of course, tend to associate All in the Family and most of the Norman Lear shows with the 60s, with 60s issues and ideas. And yet All in the Family didn't premiere until 1971. There's a kind of cultural lag that occurs where the conservative corporate sponsors that are worried about bad associations with their products and so forth have to wait until there is a sense of an ending to a period, so that period then can become part of the representational agenda of television. But some genres are more sensitive than others. The family, of course, is a very sensitive genre. Crime, on the other hand, is not quite so sensitive. So if you look at the crime show, as in 1967, you have the premiere of The Mod Squad. And here was a show that was, in its own way, addressing what's going on in the news. I mean, the news, you know, in 1964 and 5 are beginning to already show demonstrations in the streets and hippies and so forth. The crime show can respond first to that.
Can you compare the way you think movies have handled gangsters and crime and the way television has handled it?
Okay, I think the biggest difference comes about structurally because of serialization, that a television show is on week after week after week. When you go to see a James Cagney gangster film, you can be pretty sure that if he's killed someone, he's going to get either burnt in the big house or shot by a cop at the end. Well, this can't happen. Structurally, the gangster can never be the hero of the crime show. It always must be the cop. If Theo gets killed, there's no more Kojak. That's the end of the show. So we know by convention what must happen, that it's going to have a happy ending. And the Hollywood gangster film spends a lot of its time trying to make us build up sympathy for the gangster, his bad childhood, the influence of his mother, or whatever it might be. So then there is a sense of tragedy at the end of it. Well, TV has no time for this. Instead, they cannot build up that kind of sympathy, or else our hero is going to end up killing someone who we're sympathetic to. So instead, we concentrate on the heroism of the cop or the private detective, and there's very little sympathy. I mean, and the result of this is that instead of seeing crime as a sickness which is brought about by social conditions, it's the devil's evil. There's no time to explain it. We don't even want to. The bad guy simply has to be blown away or locked up, and it would be counterproductive, in fact, to develop any kind of sympathy.
The first crime shows on television were produced during the McCarthy period. Do you think that that affected the tone of the shows and the tone that those shows set for future crime shows?
Oh, sure. Dragnet was a show made in McCarthy heaven. There was Sergeant Joe Friday pitted in an unrelenting battle against evil, and evil included, crimes of all kinds, and it was essentially a crime to be a communist, and so this was all one. Another effect that the McCarthy era had, this is a little bit unrelated, but a very important thing that relates to the issue of authorship on TV. I've interviewed a number of producers who worked early in the industry, and they all tell me that one of the reasons nobody understands credits on TV, you know, you see all these things go spinning by associate executive producer to the assistant of the director or whatever, is because during the McCarthy era, everyone was so afraid that they would be named if there was something bad in the script and then they would lose their job, that they made up all these titles so it became indecipherable. You know, they could just point the other way if the witch hunters came and say, "Oh, I'm only the associate assistant to the producer. That's not my job. I don't know anything about it." And so TV bears the birthmarks of having been born during McCarthyism, in a sense, both in its form and its content.
You suggest that 77 Sunset Strip marked a real change in the tone of crime shows. What was that change?
Well, Dragnet was so incredibly popular when it came out. It changed the face of all crime shows. Virtually every crime show that had been on the air beforehand was taken off, and all new shows such as Racket Squad and M Squad and The Lineup all attempted to copy Dragnet. And this went on for quite a while, 7 or 8 years. And finally, one of the great problems of TV always, when you're dealing with formula art, you begin to work out the transformations until they start to get ridiculous. I mean, at one point, Jack Webb Studio was producing a show about a California veterinarian that was, quote, based on real cases from the files of the California Veterinary Association. Well, what happened was, at that point, a little-known film director named Roy Huggins came along, who had written the novel, 77 Sunset Strip. And what he did was he shifted the focus away from the messianic crime fighter to the kind of cool private detective. And 77 Sunset Strip, in its song, for example, bongo drums are playing instead of dum-di-dum-dum. There were characters who were nominally bookmakers or other kind of what we might call light crime, whereas in they were sympathetic, friendly characters. Whereas in Dragnet, there was no such thing as light crime. Criminals were evil. You were one of us or one of them, and so you get this more differential attitude. I think many people would be interested to know, and in fact, would see the logic of the fact that The Rockford Files, a show which comes 15 years after 77 Sunset Strip, was also originally created by Roy Huggins.
Do you think that something happened in our culture to allow from that change in tone in police shows from Dragnet to 77 Sunset Strip?
Well, you know, Kennedy had been elected president. They were playing touch football out there on the White House lawn. Carolyn was riding macaroni, and Jackie was, taking us on a tour of the White House. And there was a feeling of things loosening up during that time. Even as a child, not understanding what that meant, I was 9 years old when Kennedy was elected president. I saw the media images of this, you know, being projected at that time, that now that a young family had moved into the presidency, everyone had license to act young in some way. There was a sense of the iceberg of McCarthyism finally passing by. And you could say that if the 60s did nothing else, they certainly did end McCarthy scare.
So what other shows do you see falling in line with that new image on TV? Well, like crime shows, for instance, that followed in the footsteps of 77 Sunset Strip.
Well, there were all of Huggins' own imitations of 77 Sunset Strip. Again, talk about formula art. He took this idea of having two sort of swinging bachelors in the Sun Belt and played it for all it was worth. His next show was Bourbon Street Beat, same show, New Orleans, followed by Hawaii and I, same show, Honolulu, followed by Surfside 6, same show, Miami.
Do you think the Mod Squad shifted things?
Well, Aaron Spelling is the next big author who comes in. You have in the Mod Squad a real refiguring of the idea that the white middle-class male was the crime fighter. And instead, we have this troika, this coalition of the young white, hip male, this kind of quasi-liberated or proto-liberated woman, and a former black militant now working through the system. And what he did with this is he created a new formula, which he, too, used over and over again. So the Mod Squad then is followed by his next show, The Rookies, where he goes a step further in reforming these hippies and instead puts them in police uniforms. By his next show, which is SWAT, he's actually taken hippies and turned them into a paramilitary police unit ready to use submachine guns.
What other shows did Aaron Spelling go on to do?
Well, he did Starsky and Hutch, and there you can see a bit of a change as the kind of emphasis on social consciousness was waning. We get Starsky and Hutch, who don't make the kind of bold political statements that the Mod Squad would make, but instead do most of their talking with their designer jeans and so forth. And little by little, we see the Spelling shows getting gentrified. We move to Charlie's Angels, which has a classic Spelling theme, the opening of Charlie's Angels. The three police women went to the academy but only got desk jobs. So because of this male chauvinism, they were forced to leave the police force and become detectives so they could show what they really could do. This ties it to Spelling's earlier work. But if we look at the kind of life that they live, they're really getting into a much higher socioeconomic group, and Farrah Fawcett's hairstyles and so forth. And then we get the next step, perhaps, is Heart to Heart, where the cops now, instead of hippies, they're not cops, I should say, the detectives, consist of a millionaire who does it as a hobby, and his wife, who is a novelist who does it as a hobby.
One of the things I really love about television, there's a certain kind of look that you know that the person is just tailor-made for either modeling or television acting, that it's unlikely that they'll become a cop. It's unlikely that they'll become even a social worker, you know, that they're just made for modeling or television. And on television, all those people who are made for modeling or television play cops and mm-hmm. and play all those roles in society that you just have a feeling that they weren't really going to go into, in fact, with the way they've modeled themselves.
Well, television can recreate these roles in terms of the material they have to work with. I mean, I think one of the really dire sides of the TV industry is this incredible testing that goes on. I remember, for example, when I worked at NBC, a show was in preparation called The Man from Atlantis. And Patrick Duffy was the star of that show. And essentially, what The Man from Atlantis did was walk around in bathing trunks during the whole show because he was the man from Atlantis. Now, a very important aspect of casting for this was who was getting the strongest reaction from women, especially women 18 to 34 years old, which was the focus of the show. And they simply tested, photos of men in bathing suits, and the one who got the highest reaction got the part.
Amazing.
But the other side of it is, no matter how they'd like to portray this as science, the show also lasted for 6 episodes and went off the air.
What did you do at NBC?
I worked in the program research office, and essentially I was just an office boy. But I got to do a lot of interesting Xeroxing while I was there. I learned about things, for example, like the F&Q scores, which is very, very important. It almost determines everything that's on television, which most people don't know about. There's a little company in Port Washington, New York, called Performer Q, that exists for no other reason but to do a survey every year to see, how popular people are and who knows their name. So, for example, if I show you a picture of this is how the survey works. I show you a picture of Alan Alda. If you can say, that's Alan Alda, he gets an F point. Now, if you have answered that question correctly, I then give you a questionnaire to fill out all about Alan Alda. If you give very positive answers to it, he'll get a Q point. So here's how it would work. You could take any classical show business phenomena and make a math ratio out of it. I'll give you an example. In the early days of Saturday Night Live, John Belushi might have gotten a 5F. Out of every 100 people you showed his picture to, only 5 could say, that's John Belushi. But out of those, now remember, only the people that answer the question correctly are asked the Q question. Out of those 5, 4 said, one of my favorite performers. That gives him an ADQ. So low F and high Q means a cult figure. You know, and you can explain almost any kind of thing like that. Now, it's very easy to create F. All I have to do is put you on Merv and Johnny and so forth, and we can create familiarity or F. But the question is, how do you create love, which is Q? And I'm glad to say it's still a mystery.
I should ask you about Hill Street Blues. Are you one of the real fans of Hill Street Blues?
Yeah, I enjoy the show, though. I feel that it's running into some problems lately, which is okay with me, you know, because I'm not a sponsor paying to have millions of people look at my product. I mean, I'm willing to live with the show through problems and see if it can solve them. But lately, I've become more interested in Saint Elsewhere. I find it holding my attention more. They're so self-conscious about playing with conventions. They'll almost always go for whatever you don't expect. And so it's like a little game that's being played there. There's a terrorist, and you expect that the terrorist will be converted to decent values as he might have been on Dr. Kildare or whatever if he were. And instead, he'll get assassinated. And there's a kind of mixing of genres that goes on there, which the MTM company is famous for in a way. Lou Grant, for example, taking a character from a sitcom that's been on the air for 6 years, and then all of a sudden plucking the character out of a sitcom and putting him into a non-comic drama. And one of the strengths of MTM is that they're not bound by those sacred cows. And I think that really intelligent viewers enjoy that. People who've watched TV all their lives and know what's supposed to happen in a sitcom and it's supposed to happen in a crime show like to see the genres being violated. It's also the pleasure of watching Saturday Night Live, especially when it was really strong in the late 70s with Gilda Radner and Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray, or SCTV. Because what they'll do is they'll tell us something about watching television. When Gilda Radner is playing Lucille Ball, she's doing better TV criticism than has ever been written before. She's making all of those hundreds of hours we've spent watching Lucy really worth something.
There are a lot of people who think that television is terrible and that it's not only the programming, that there's something really cursed about the medium. It will never be any good. And there's books like Jerry Mander's Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television.
Yeah, of course, a book like that written by someone who's made millions in the advertising industry, it may just be a guilt problem he's having while living in retirement. But I think the important thing is this. If television contains a lot of bad things, it's all the more reason why not to ignore it. We really need to talk about it. It's our cultural currency. It's really the thing that two people from any place in America can get together and talk to each other about. And I think that if we try to push it aside and make believe that our culture is something else, that it's producing great drama whatever the genteel fad might be, I think that we're going to lose control of the culture. And to a large extent, that's happened. Very few people in the humanities, for example, will come down off the mountain to talk about television. And these are the people who are best trained in our society to talk about storytelling and storytelling traditions and what's going on. And instead, this is being left to number crunchers. The point is, whatever comes in the future, whatever new stuff, and of course new stuff will come. Children will grow up, in the third and fourth generation of television and do things that no one even imagined. But whatever comes, all that early stuff, Leave It to Beaver, I Love Lucy, The Honeymooners, that'll be the history of it. Those will be the Greek plays of television. And in order to deviate from them, you're going to have to refer to them. You're going to have to know what they are. There's going to have to be some commentary on them to make them legible to people 100 years from now, just in the same way that you can't read, Alexander Pope's poetry without footnotes in the 20th century. You're going to need some footnotes to understand what these early tapes were about. And I think it's a good thing that people are starting to do this.
That was television critic David Mark, who writes for The Atlantic Magazine and The Village Voice. His book about television, Demographic Vistas, is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The technical director for this edition was Ron Barron. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible by support from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and its 16 undergraduate, graduate, and professional schools. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.